Barge? I cannot imagine, Mrs. Frost, what can have made my house convenient to you. Mrs. Frost gives a laugh. She has spent some time working up to sound bell-like. You are a sharp one. All right, I have come to visit you. I wish to speak with you. May I come in? She is already stepping past her. Upstairs, is it? To your dear little, parlour? I cannot offer you tea, Angelica says, following her up. I have sent my maid out. She has taken contributions to the poor. Mr. Hancock and I have been blessed with far more than we need. I see. I see. They sit down together. Mrs. Frost gives Angelica a long, shrewd look, as if she were a favourite schoolmistress dealing with an unruly pupil. You think I've abandoned you? Angelica frowns. You believe I have profited from you and then cast you aside. Do not speak yet. Hear me out, my dear. For this is not so. My dove, this is not so. I have not forgotten you, not for one moment. I owe everything I have to you. That part is true. I freely admit it. It is all I speak of when I'm in London. Everybody knows. But since I was separated from you, oh, I wept for you. I thought of how lonely you must be here and how cruelly we'd been separated. You could have come too. He offered. You would not come. Angelica, you had to think of your own interests. You do not need to be ashamed of that. I forgive you. You would not come with me. Since your fortune's turned, Mrs. Frost raises her voice a little, all I have thought about is how to restore you to your previous position. You took such a fall. I have been striving to create a situation you might return to. But I live here now. Exactly. I can get you out. She leans closer, a gust of violet pastels and tooth decay. My big house, my lovely grand house, you will have everything you need. Your own apartment, a little servant of your own, an Abyssinian boy like you always had a fancy for, and we shall get him up in livery and you can teach him tricks. I can do that for you. And you can keep your own hours and go to the theatre every night of the week. But I am quite happy here. You need not adopt such a front with me. I know you. You know nothing. I do not want to come away from this place. You would not credit how many of your old friends are dying to have you back. They always ask me, that Angelica Neal, when will she return to us? And yet I have heard from none of them. I can give you very good rates, better than the little girls I'm taking on. And I know you will have no trouble earning. You could buy yourself out whenever you liked. You wish me to become a whore? I would not say whore. You never were a mercenary, I know that. You would never be obliged. Angelica is stupefied. You wish me to become a whore in your establishment? It is the least I could do for you. You would be absolutely free to choose. I have so many charming girls, and they will really do anything they're told. But not one of them is established. If we had a figurehead, a famous name, just to draw people in... No. Oh, no, no. I am finished with all that, Mrs. Frost. She stands up. Please leave. It will always be there for you. I am married. What? Forever? A vein on Mrs. Frost's temple begins to twitch. How long do you believe you can do this for? This piffling little house, that idiot man. I suppose you think you're virtuous. Well, you are not.
You have merely lowered your expectations. Brown paint and oilcloth? Angelica Neal? This is not you.
I think you are jealous.
Jealous? Why? Because you are pretty? Because you are married?
Jealous? You arrive in my house all puffed up like a cat who has run into a terrier, and you try so very hard to persuade me that I am nothing and you are something that in the end I simply cannot credit it.
Do you know, says Mrs. Frost, how they speak of you? That Mrs. Neal, everybody says, who stooped to marry a nobody, who threw away all her opportunities, who could not tolerate the difficulties of this life she chose. You're a laughing stock, my dear.
You have made a quite serious misjudgment. My husband has bought me my own house, Greenwich. We are rising in the world. I do not need you or Mrs. Chapel or anybody. I am free.
You are helpless. You are kept. You go where you find yourself best supported, as you always have. Perhaps you mistake this for independence. But you're still a whore.
Angelica slaps her quick as a whip.
Out! Get out! Get out of my house!
Mrs. Frost shows no agitation. She saunters across the room, Angelica's palm print blooming faintly under the crust of lead white.
Out!
Says Angelica, louder. She snatches up the broom from the landing and comes at her as if she were chasing out a black beetle. Mrs. Frost shrieks and leaps and darts for the stairs, but Angelica pursues her, beating at Mrs. Frost's skirt with the broom all the way down, until by the last step the wretched board has completely lost her composure and yelps,
"Let me go! Let me go!"
She hurls herself out of the door and onto Union Street, where the footman urinates dreamily in an alley, and a stray dog urinates against the wheel of her carriage.
James! James! Get back to your post! We are leaving!
Angelica's face is red, and her eyes are gleaming. Her yellow hair is bursting out from under her cap. She stands on the step, brandishing her broom, and shrieks to all around,
"This woman is a bawd! She runs a most disreputable nunnery, and she condemns me, me, for my honest situation!"
Those few people walking in Union Street, and it is a fine street, home to gentlefolk, turn to stare. Mrs. Frost is scrambling into her carriage, slipping and snatching in her agitation. Faces appear at windows, and a boy puts down his barrow of dung to watch.
"An old spinster getting rich off pretty girls,"
continues Angelica, quite hoarse.
"She sells other women's virtue, but retains her own. Now tell me, do you think that's fair? Do you think it is possible?"
The footman flicks the reins, and the carriage bounces down the street.
"Go!" Angelica shrieks. "Don't come back here! This is no place for you!"
Bridget, returned from her errand to the sheetless poor, is hurrying down the street. Suki, some distance behind, breaks into a run, lamenting,
"Oh, no, Mrs. Hancock, not in the street!"
They gather about her in breathless consternation.
"What has she done?"
asks Bridget.
"Come inside, I beg you,"
whispers Suki, pulling her to the threshold. But Angelica is rigid with rage.
"I will see this woman off first!"
"Come inside," says Bridget. "She's gone, madam. She's gone."
They take Angelica by the arms and gently but firmly steer her into the house.
"Bolt the door,"
she says once they are inside, her face remarkable pale and remarkable still.
"What happened?"
asks Suki, putting a shawl about her aunt's shoulders.
"She is a vile, coarse woman. This is a respectable household. My husband is a gentleman." "Of course. Come into the kitchen. Sit down. Let me make you a drink.
I can make you a cordial. I'm all right. Only shaken. I saw her off, girls. She wipes her eyes with the back of her wrist and grins. She will not come back here, but I shall give you some advice, and you will both do well to heed me. Hold on to your virtue. Hold on to your virtue, because do you know why? Well, yes, says Suki, who has read many books on the subject. Because I shall tell you why. Because if you do not, it is snakes like Mrs. Frost who will profit by it. And that, mark my words, is if you are fortunate. Otherwise, you will find yourself in the care of a man who goes by the name of Crusher, or the Gent. And these are not good people, and you will not take any part in encouraging them. No, I shall not. No. Learn from me. Now, I shall take that cordial.
Chapter 7. April 1786. One morning in mid-April, Angelica says to herself, "It is time I accepted that I am pregnant." She is in bed at the time, Mr. Hancock having risen for the day, sitting up to watch the white clouds chase one another across the sky outside the window, and the thought leaps into her head very suddenly and perfectly formed. Everything becomes clear. She realizes that beneath the surface of her mind she has been thinking and counting and puzzling for some time, that she knows her own symptoms perfectly well, and that the plain fact of her impending motherhood has sat unattended for quite long enough now. She flops onto her back, resting her hand on her stomach, which has always been a plump little stomach, so there is little to discern, although she feels it well enough, and says to herself, "This is absurd." In Dean Street she would have been more vigilant. She would have understood at once what was happening. "In Dean Street, I would never have allowed this to happen," she thinks, and feels stupid, because her instinct to obstruct this sort of development is no longer suitable for her situation. However, she cannot think how else to feel. Angelica knows prophylaxis the way other girls know the catechism. She keeps a vinegared sponge in her cabinet and knows what to do with a condom. She can time a gentleman's withdrawal to the most exquisite second. She will accept his spending on whichever part of her person he most admires. In exceptional situations, she will indulge in the Frenchman's vice. In the event of an oversight, she might calmly draw herself a scalding bath and a quart of gin, or, in a case of greater urgency, call in on Mrs. Chapel to acquire from her a good purgative. If further aid were required, she would not find herself abandoned. Every woman she knew had a little piece of advice, or a commiseratory glass of sack, and word would be passed round until the proper expert with the proper equipment were found. It would not be pleasant, and sometimes less pleasant than others, but it would all be settled after one small burst of activity and anxiety. All would be well, and all concluded to her own choosing. Now, friendless and without the first idea of how to find a midwife specializing in live births, Angelica is out of her element. "What shall I do?" she panics over and over, and can only conclude, "I can do nothing. I must do nothing." She can only wait for this baby to be born. It agitates her, this lack of agency. She feels itchy and restless. She flops about in bed, and then she gets up and paces the room. If such a significant thing is really to occur, why does she not have more to do? This, she realizes, is the end of Angelica Neal and the cementing of Mrs. Hancock. She had anticipated only that marriage would deliver her from her old situation, In fact, it has transplanted her to another, that knits itself under her very skin and alters her every day. More has slipped from her control than she had expected, and now she sees that, as the months and years pass, it will only slip further. She will never be simply her own self in the world again. The courtesan Angelica Neal, a personality all her own, is being parcelled up and claimed by connection upon connection. She is wife of and aunt of. Later she will be mother of. Perhaps some energetic young man whose achievements will never be traced back to she who birthed him. These claims upon her will only multiply. She will be mother-in-law, grandmother, widow, dependent. And accordingly, her own person will be divided and divided and divided until there is nothing left. "Well, I have done it now," she says. She pulls her shawl around her and puts on her slippers and trots down the stairs to her husband's counting house. She taps on the door.
"Come in," he calls.
She opens the door. He is hunched over his desk, as usual, wigless, absent-mindedly rubbing the cat under the chin. The little creature has squeezed her eyes shut in her pleasure, paws folded one over the other.
"Good morning," says Angelica.
"Good morning."
He does not look up. He works his way around the cat's jaw with the tips of his stained fingers, and then begins to stroke her behind her ears. She purrs thunderously. Angelica's stomach is aflutter with nerves.
"Are you ready for breakfast?"
Oh, let me see.
He rummages through his papers with one hand, the other never leaving the cat.
"I am particularly busy today. Perhaps I shall dine with you."
He glances up to catch her eye apologetically.
"So much to do, my dear."
"Mr. Hancock,"
says Angelica more firmly. Then she realizes that she does not know what to say.
"What would you..."
she tries.
"I mean, if you were... I think that I..."
He turns round to look at her, his arm hooked over the back of his chair.
"Spit it out," he says.
"I hardly know how."
"'Tis not bad news."
No, good news. I venture you will like it very much."
She realizes that her face is hot. She is blushing, and her cheeks have leapt into a grin. The anticipation of his joy makes her feel giddy.
"Mr. Hancock,"
she tries again, clasping her hands behind her back.
"Oh, sir, I am in for it."
"Beg pardon?"
"I am in the way of increasing."
"You are..."
"A baby. We're going to have a baby."
"Oh."
He rises from his seat in one movement. The cat flees and the ink bottle overturns. He takes Angelica in his arms, kissing her face and hair.
"My little pigeon, my darling, what news! So clever!"
"I am pleased,"
she says tentatively. Then she says again,
"I am pleased,"
because it is true. She has made an unremarkable, middling type of man weep with the most innocent joy. This is something to be pleased about. If she is to deliver a child, it might as well be to the sort of man who will dote on it.
"When?"
he says, clasping her elbows.
"In time for Christmas, I think."
"Oh, my dear, we shall be so happy. You and I, my little wife, and a child of our own. I could not want for more."
"Nor I," she says.
"I told you I would make you happy. You are more than content, are you not?"
"Oh, sir,"
she dabs her eyes with her handkerchief. Of course. Chapter 8. That very same night, Mr. Hancock sends out for sugar plums and meat pies and for neighbours to join in his pleasure in a private, friendly gathering. He also sends for his sister Hester, who, although she strives to be cordial, cannot help hissing to him upon her arrival.
How can you be short as yours?
Those others in attendance are a motley group, from a nicer class of Deptford folk than those Mr. Hancock has habitually gone amongst, for his star is rising. The tenants of Hancock Row are all there, or rather the gentlemen are. The dancing master, the doctor, the fellow who has very lately opened a tea warehouse on Butt Lane itself. Jem Thorpe and the master shipwright are present also, frowning at the company. It used to be that there was only one sort of man in Deptford society, clever with his hands and with a mind for figures, whose living, if it did not come out of a ship, was no living at all. These landlocked, leisured citizens are a breed quite apart. Where have they sprung from? And what can be made of them? There is one thing they agree on, however. They have all, to a man, presented themselves alone, without wives, sisters, or children.
"Say," says Mr. Hancock, "what's this? This company is very short of ladies."
The new friends clutch their rummers and smile nervously, murmuring their apologies.
"What?"
he asks.
"Speak up! Speak up! Not one of you can finish a sentence."
Angelica, taking his elbow, steers him into a confiding huddle.
"Their wives will not be about me," she whispers.
"No, but that is absurd."
She shrugs.
"Perfectly sensible. I am not decent company."
"You are my wife, are you not?"
"Aye, but," she sighs, "they will not wish to meet me. And their husbands will not wish it either."
Although when she turns around, she finds them all craning and staring to see her, for they have heard of her and seen her likeness shared around.
"You may be certain that they are under the strictest instructions to remember everything they see, that they might describe it in great detail when they are home."
"But will they never visit? You must have female society."
Angelica has a great wish all of a sudden to see dear Belle, to ask her, "How did you manage this?" Belle would have an answer. Belle would be kind. But then Belle's cohort are all gentry, titled and landed. They are not the wives of middling provincial men. They are a breed quite apart.
"Maybe they will unbend," she says. "I shall endeavour to be their sort. If I make a good impression tonight, they cannot take against me, I'm sure."
Suki, setting up the clavichord, watches them whisper together, her uncle's eyes very fond upon his wife. She does not find Angelica onerous company, but she is crestfallen that Mr. Hancock's attention has so quickly been transferred. She had thought herself central to his life. That he seems so quickly to have forgot her is discomforting.
"Brandy!"
cries Mr. Hancock, and thus they toast the coming child, he with his arm about Mrs. Hancock's waist, she blushing and pretty. Even Mrs. Lippard smiles and laughs. The baby may be a mere tadpole, but it binds their union as nothing else might. There is no ousting Mrs. Hancock now. Bridget nips into the room, and tugging at Mr. Hancock's sleeve, informs him that there is a gentleman for him at the door.
"More visitors?" says Mr. Hancock. "What fun! Bring 'em in! Bring 'em in!"
But when Bridget beckons him down into the hall, he finds it is only a messenger boy.
"Are you wanting a reply?"
asks Mr. Hancock.
"No, sir. Only to see you take receipt of the message. 'Tis important."
I see.
Mr. Hancock inspects the seal on the note. It is impressed, God be praised, with Captain Jones's anchor signet.
Thank you. Will you have a drop of brandy?
Thank you, sir. No, sir. I must away.
Once the boy has gone, Mr. Hancock gazes again upon the seal.
News from my ship,
he says to himself, as the muted notes of the clavichord drift down the stairs, accompanied by the laughter and hum of his assembled new friends.
Momentous, perhaps. As if I required any more moment in my life.
He thinks of the fever with which he had demanded a new mermaid, the hectic bliss when news came that one had been found. And now?
Why, it does not matter. I have everything I want. The addition of a wonder to my life will improve it not one whit.
And if it is bad news, therefore, if the creature is lost or proved a forgery, then it matters not one whit either. Even so, he is not quite easy, and goes upstairs to fetch his wife. She is standing by the clavichord, turning the pages for Suki. When he enters the room, she turns her face to him with an expression of gentle happiness.
"What was it?"
she asks quietly, so as not to interrupt Suki's performance. But seeing the expression on her husband's face, she steps away from the instrument all the same, beckoning the dancing master to take her place.
No, I have not opened it yet. I hope perhaps you would. 'Tis from Captain Jones.
Their eyes grow large.
He has returned?
I do not know. Open it.
She slides her finger under the seal and unfolds the paper carefully. It is a damp and dirty sheet, its contents made out in the most ragged of scrawls. It reads as follows.
Mr. Hancock, sir, the good ship Unicorn has docked safely. I beg that you meet me at Greenland Dock tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock, to take receipt of its most cumbersome and unusual cargo. Yours, etc., Captain Tissot Jones. P.S. She is alive.
In this quiet bubble, something is growing. It doubles and doubles and doubles again, unseen. And moment on moment on moment, it begins to wake up, becomes more of itself. Slowly, it will start to extend itself, to stretch out like a tap root from a tight seed, or to swell like a tadpole, limbs knotted within its body. But although it is like these things, it is certainly neither of these things. It is only itself. If it thinks, it does not know it is thinking. If it feels, it does not know it is feeling. But it strives without knowing it is striving. It surges towards life without knowing what life might be. And although it has no understanding of attainment, to attain is its sole instinct. It has no idea of age, but it conquers seconds and minutes and hours. It lives now, and now, and now. Each moment bubbles into the next, and once gone, is quite forgotten. It might be the oldest thing in the world, for all it knows. It might be the very newest. This something sleeps in the dark, a secret even to itself. People who have never seen it might credit it with fingers, eyelashes, a voice. But how can they know? Who knows what it does in its small bubble when it does not even know itself? They will suggest it has a moral code, a motive, a divine purpose, a soul worth stealing. They assume its rules might be the same as theirs. They are wrong. It is a seed, crammed with everything it will ever need. It beds down. It swims. It flies. Blind and deaf and dumb in its sensual world, it rides on tides of dreams. It knows, or does not know, the roil and churn of fluid all about it, and the thud and rush of some eternal comforting tide. What it knows is that it is part of something bigger. What it knows, if it knows, is that something is about to happen. It is prepared at every moment for something to happen. Something is about to happen. Chapter 9. Mr. Hancock has never set an alarm in his life. Dawn is such a logical time to awake that he does so without complaint or difficulty. This particular morning, his eyes snap open as the bells in St. Nicholas's spire sound the third of six chimes, and is in an instant as perfectly awake as if he had never been asleep.
"Mermaid,"
he says in the dark, and sits up. He cannot see much, it being dark and the bed curtains being half drawn, but he can feel Angelica, warm and sweaty, curled up next to him, and he pats what he supposes to be her shoulder. She squeaks like a kitten.
"Your mermaid has arrived," he whispers. "Will you come and see her with me?"
"There is no mermaid,"
she mumbles, rolling over onto her belly.
"Wake up, Mrs. Hancock."
"No, sir."
"I cannot persuade you."
"Go and satisfy yourself it is real. I'll not make the journey for a silly toy."
"I suppose rest is of particular importance to you," he says, "in your happy condition."
He opens the bed curtains and eases himself out. She sprawls into the space he has left while he hops about with one foot in his breeches as silently as he can manage. On the way out of the bedroom, he cracks his shin on the blanket chest and spits hoarse curses.
"Shh," says Angelica. "Forgive me. Forgive me."
He tiptoes downstairs as light as a ballerina. Bridget is coming from the kitchen, carrying a full coal scuttle.
"Good morning,"
he says, bursting with contentment. But she squints and scowls blearily at him, and says nothing. The shutters, at least, are open, and the hall is all awash with spring sunshine.
"A glorious day,"
he remarks, as the cat follows him out onto the street.
"An important day. I am to be a father at last. And my ship has come in, the Unicorn, the most important of them all."
The cat zigzags the road from gutter to gutter, her little snout close to the ground, her whiskers twitching. She is hungry.
"You imagine this is of no consequence to you," said Mr. Hancock. "But this business is what keeps you in bacon rinds."
When they reach the tall walls and slaughterhouse fug of the Admiralty victualling yard, Mr. Hancock and the cat part ways. She darts into the shadows, her tail standing up like a mast. He strikes out across the fields, where the air swells moist and green-smelling. The birds are clamorous, and three red cows watch from under their eyelashes as he hoists himself over a stile, breeches straining. From here, a long tree-lined avenue leads to Greenland Dock, and he idles happily along it, kicking up dust and screwing his eyes so the sunshine glows pink through his lids. As he draws closer, the air takes on an oily weight, which settles on the clothes and layers the nostrils with a greasy, deep-water scent. And the nearer he comes, the worse the smell becomes, until it blooms into the stench of ghastly decay. The blankets of flesh, peeled from whales on the Greenland ice, have lain for days and weeks upon the ships that bear them home, reeking and sweating and oozing. On the docks, the labourers hoist them one by one from their piles, retching and leaning against one another as they unleash pockets of trapped gas and foul, greasy fluid that have hitherto saturated undisturbed. These unfortunate men have never seen a live whale, but they are experts in its parts. Fat for soap and lamps, spermaceti for smokeless candles, baleen for their sweethearts' corsets. The rendering ovens in the long brick buildings on the near side of the dock are already roaring hot, while the labourers fill vats with spongy rashes of blubber. Mr. Hancock approaches a group taking air on the quayside.
"Good morning, boys," he says.
"Morning to you. We don't see you here so often."
"No, indeed. I did not expect to be here today, but I have been summoned on some mysterious business. Is Captain Tyso Jones about the place?"
One of them jerks his head back towards the edge of the dock, and there he stands by the water, tall and narrow and all alone in the midst of this industry, his face white and immobile. He is turning his hat around and around in his hands in a constant motion, as if it were some ritual of prayer.
"He's not so good," says one of the dockers.
"A bad voyage," says another.
"They do get that way sometimes."
He taps his temple meaningfully.
"Crazed." "I see,"
says Mr. Hancock, who indeed has seen it before.
"He needs a rest."
He approaches his old friend, smiling and reaching out his hand. But although Captain Jones looks as if he is waiting for something, and his eyes are roving and expectant, he does not seem to see him.
"From the looks of it, you've had a hard voyage," says Mr. Hancock. "Eh, Tyso? But you're home now."
His friend tears away his eyes from an invisible point in the air and fixes them with difficulty upon Mr. Hancock's lapel. He is silent for a moment. A muscle in his jaw seems to be working.
"Yes,"
he says presently.
"You might say so."
"Here, Tyso."
Mr. Hancock's jubilance bubbles up before he can suppress it.
"Much has changed in my circumstances. You'll not credit it. I've a wife, sir."
Captain Jones remains impassive.
"And she has one in the basket already,"
persists Mr. Hancock.
"I'm to be a father. What do you say to that, hey?"
But for perhaps the first time in his life, Captain Jones has nothing at all to say. He nods absently, that is all, leaving Mr. Hancock to stammer and cough and then ask lamely,
"And how were your travels?" "Strange."
His old friend's eyes will not meet his. He mumbles into his stock. Then his eyes roll off into the middle distance again.
"Do you know?"
Mr. Hancock hesitates, perturbed at his friend's strangeness.
"You took far longer to return than you'd expected."
He longs for the gratification of a warm handshake, a clap about the shoulders. He regrets that his old friend does not rejoice in his achieving this most masculine of things. But what signifies more is that something is gravely amiss. Captain Jones shrugs.
"What's time, anyway? And we are not meeting in the usual place,"
prompts Mr. Hancock.
"No, this is not the usual cargo. So..."
They stand for a minute longer, silent. Then Captain Jones says,
"Come with me."
He sets off with a little burst of energy and moves quite rapidly in a sort of lurching shuffle. His limbs wobble like a puppet's, and his feet never quite leave the ground. In this way, he leads Mr. Hancock along the length of the dock, where the ships jostle gently together like cattle, and towards a tumble-down warehouse beyond. When they are just a few yards away from it, his footsteps falter and cease. He stands still again, looking at the ground.
"I got you what you want,"
he says.
"I found her. But I think perhaps you should not have her."
"What?"
"She will not be what you expect. She is not what I expected, Lord knows."
"I expect nothing. I expected a dead one."
"Well, I can assure you, she's not dead."
He snorts mirthlessly.
"I do not know if I would call her alive, but she's not dead."
They step into the shadowy warehouse. Squinting, Mr. Hancock sees that one of the big-bellied rendering vats has been dragged from its shed, its passage across the stone floor marked by clawing lines of soot. Mr. Hancock advances slowly. To his surprise, Captain Jones keeps talking.
"Every sailor is heartsick, at least sometimes in his life. But this was the most melancholy voyage I ever knew."
The water, for the vat is surely full of water and not oil, gives a little plash, as if something very large has rolled gently over in it.
"We installed her quite comfortably in the hold. At first, the crew was in good spirits. I would always catch one or other of my boys down there, just gazing at her. But after a while..."
The vat is as tall as Mr. Hancock, and he cannot see inside. He slaps his palm against its scorched side.
"Have you any steps? I wish to look." "Well, by and by, every man on that ship was overcome by grief. A sort of melancholy hollowness, as if each one of us had been gutted like a fish. Everything warm and substantial taken out and thrown away."
Captain Jones remains in the doorway, just shy of the thin shaft of sunlight that creeps in. He begins again to turn his hat around in his hands.
"How to describe it if you've never felt it?"
he says softly. Perhaps he's talking to himself, but he wishes to be heard. His voice is high and urgent.
"It's like realizing that one is no longer in love. The restlessness. Nobody looked anybody in the eye. Nobody spoke or sang. It was as if every soul on that ship suddenly knew that somewhere in the world there was a great love just for them, but that the world was so large they would never find it." "I did not know you were so poetical," says Mr. Hancock.
He drags an empty keg up to the vat, climbs onto it, and peers inside. The water stirs. In the dark, it appears quite black, apart from the mica booming through it like stars. At first he thinks, "Why? There's nothing here. My wife was right. I've been duped." Then the water heaves a great sigh, rainbows glance across the copper, and he sees her. She is indistinct, but there is no doubting she is there. She is like a shoal of tiny fish, all surging and flickering together, a great mass that forms and reforms and thinks all in accord. He can make out sometimes her arms and often her swirling hair. He sees the silvery rolling over of her heavy tail. He hangs over the water for many minutes as she sighs and rolls.
"Oh,"
he says.
"And when we disembarked last night," continues Captain Jones, "we all knew we will never sail together again. We who were like brothers. I do not know where they will all go. Not back to their homes, for they have no homes that feel like home."
He contemplates this statement for a moment before repeating it, turning it over as if it were a curiosity he needed to inspect.
"They have no homes that feel like home."
Then he straightens up.
Take her away. You are fortunate we did not scuttle the ship, but we'd have done it gladly. I've a mind to return to sea again as soon as possible. What is there for me here? What good is money?
Mr. Hancock is not listening. I must tell Angelica, he says, squinting into the waters once again. I must go at once. Even so, he remains leaning over the vat for many seconds longer. Chapter 10.
Ugh,
says Angelica Hancock, opening her eyes. Something is happening. She finds she is in a great deal of pain.
Oh,
she says again and gets out of bed. Her legs will not do as she tells them. Her belly is gripped by something. She drops to her knees and vomits into the chamber pot. Not much.
Ugh!
She heaves from her diaphragm. She kneels there for a moment or two, palms pressed flat to the floor, spitting saliva that glides in gobbets down threads suspended between her lips and the pot, which stretch and dangle but will not break. She waits to see if she will vomit again. No. She wipes her mouth with the back of her hand and shunts the chamber pot back under the bed, where her hair will not trail in it. But she cannot get up. She kneels, her body folded tightly with her feet under her buttocks and her knees under her breasts, as if she were trying to parcel herself up, hold herself together. The pain in her belly is phenomenal.
I know what this is,
she says out loud. She is almost exasperated. It is not the first time in her life. She raises herself off the floor a little, one hand pressed to her stomach, and puts the other in between her legs. It comes away bloodier than she had expected. It gleams like a beetle back as she holds it in front of her face, splaying her fingers out. The blood stretches in mucus webs.
Oh, dear Jesus!
There is a sob swelling in her throat. When she rolls her eyes heavenwards, she catches the sheets on the bed, smeared and blotched.
Oh, Jesus! What a mess! What a state! That will not wash out!
She crouches there for a long while, hunched over her pain, as if her body only exists to contain it. Her ankles are trembling, and she lets her head hang so that all she can see is a wall of her own hair. After a while, she drags the sheet off the bed and jams it between her legs. She rolls over onto her side and curls there, knees to her chest, pressing her hands to her face. The creases in her palms are sticky and smell of her own emissions. She does not weep, though. All other things being equal, she would be bawling like a hungry lamb, for she has little tolerance for pain and has rarely felt so sorry for herself. But something prevents her. She knows what is happening, and she feels a terrible sadness.
Stay with me,
she whispers, and the tears run over the bridge of her nose, spread over her cheek, and pool on the floorboards.
Stay with me. Oh, what will I do without you?
There is no stopping it, of course. The only thing she can think to do is what she has been taught before, on other occasions after the usual ritual of hot baths, strenuous walks, patented tonics. Breathe. No, breathe. You'll be better for it. In, out. In, out. Blow it all out, she was told. Blow it all out. And she would blow, long and even, until all her breath was gone, and it felt as if the two walls of her lungs might stick together. On those occasions, there were other women around her, rubbing her back and shushing in her ears. She howled on those occasions, but only with the pain. Afterwards, there would be sweet wine, and a clean bed, and eventually laughter. Now she is alone on the floor of her marital chamber. She blows all the air out of her lungs in a long and steady stream, and in this way she is able to manage her pain, more or less, at least enough to bear witness to the passing of this thing. Suki must have heard her from her bedroom, for she pokes her head around the door and sees her leg knotted in the stained sheet, little bloodied fingerprints on her face.
Mrs. Hancock!
Angelica does not uncurl herself. She does not get up from the floor.
I think it is done, she says. I think it is too late. Let me help you. No, no! I can't get up! Don't touch me! Come on.
She hoicks her up by the armpits, carefully unlooping the sheet from her legs. Angelica cries as it falls away from her.
Now then, it's all right. Don't look. Don't look. I'll see to that.
Somewhere in the streaked folds of the sheet might be found, if it is large enough to be seen, if it can be recognized, if it even exists in one piece, the tiny clotted froglet that Angelica carried.
Come, into bed. I'll get things to bathe you. It's too late, Angelica repeats. There is nothing as could have been done. This is just what happens sometimes.
Oh, how would you know?
How would you?
Snaps Suki. Angelica dissolves into tears.
Your uncle,
she says. How pleased he would have been to have a living child. How delighted. And how he would have loved her for it. She cannot have it. Her 2 months' family prized apart like an oyster shell.
You must not tell him, she says. But what shall I? If he comes home this morning, tell him I'm unwell. Tell Bridget so, too. There is no need for him to know anything yet. I shall sleep it off. I shall be all right. I do not wish him to see me lose my composure. And if he sends for you, he will want to show you the mermaid.
There is no point even considering that possibility, says Angelica, climbing into her bloodied bed. There is no mermaid. I do not believe there ever was one.
Chapter 11.
Well, what is she like?
Angelica asks her husband at dinner that evening. He has stumbled in late and peculiar flat around the eyes. But she is in no state to mark this, she being only an hour out of bed herself, and less than an hour rinsed of the last traces of her loss. She feels those smears and fingerprints of blood as a mark of guilt. Standing over the tub in the kitchen, she scrubbed at them and clenched her teeth with sorrow. And so it is a peculiar meal, not their usual happy troughing, although she's put on her prettiest chintz and had Bridget puff the powder into her hair.
Hmm? He says.
Your mermaid.
Oh.
He toys his fork across his plate.
"'Tis hard to explain.
In truth, he does not know what to make of it. He had wanted to dash back to her bed, to tell her about this thing he can make no sense of. But something had rooted him quite to the spot. Instead, he found himself standing over that vat for minutes that stretched into hours, searching the water for the shifting creature within. She does not press him. Indeed, she hardly hears him. Her thoughts have crept somewhere deep inside her, a little fist of pain at the centre of her body. She returns again and again to her own disbelief, that no sooner has this small thing been given to her than it is taken away again. And how could she have done differently? Has she walked too often in the evening chill? Has she been too active or not active enough? Or was it her own thoughts that poisoned the child? Did it taste her lack of fitness? Did it starve for the love she had been slow to extend to it? Oh, God, or is this a judgment on my past deeds? The food is ashes in her mouth. She pushes her plate away. Her husband hardly looks at her. Perhaps he knows and is angry. She tries to catch his eye, but he sees nothing in the room at all. He is thinking, in fact, of how to keep his new-found mermaid, for it is clear she cannot stay at the whaling dock forever. What is required for her is a good-sized pool. But this answer, of course, breeds more questions. How long do mermaids live? This one seems hardly to be alive in the usual sense, so perhaps she cannot be presumed to die. And must the water be saline? She is, after all, from the sea. He wishes he were a scientific man. And yet surely this phenomenon cannot be explained by science. His mind creeps to the feeling he had as he leant over the vat. He thought it contained something far larger than it appeared, as if a huge void were opening up where before all was solid and dull. A strange prickling rushes over his whole body, and he thinks suddenly of Henry, of Mary, who in the midst of life were in death.
Futility creeps on us everywhere, he thinks, flourishing one day, cut down the next. And if a man may be taken from his work at any moment, the only thing that can be hoped for is that he will leave some mark of himself behind in the footprint of a building or the pounding heart of his own child. If he leaves nothing, who can say he lived at all?
His mouth is dry. He has not felt it at all since his marriage, but all of a sudden he is fearful, and most certain that these fragile things he has will soon be snatched again from his grasp. There are words in his head that he did not put there, but he cannot quite make them out. He sighs and reaches across the table for his wife's hand. Chapter 12. May 1786. He is absent every day. She does not know where he goes, but he is not in the bed when she wakes up, and she walks his house all day, knowing she will not find him in any of its rooms. It grasps at her heart, as if he has abandoned her. She tries to make ready for their removal with Bridget and Suki, but her pace is so dull and directionless that they soon lose patience.
"Stir yourself!"
Suki says, the day Angelica stands for 20 minutes in the middle of the parlour, holding a single tea-bowl in her cupped palm.
"'Tis not right that I must do everything. The lists I write that you do not care even to read. The arrangements I have made that are surely more your business than mine, and he is no better."
"'I'm sorry,' whispers Angelica. There are dark shadows under her eyes. The loss of the child feels to her an omen, and the closer the day comes for them to depart, the greater her dread grows. Her husband would have her installed in a great house, the shining jewel at the centre of a finely worked setting, and she thinks, "It cannot be. I am no match for any of it. I shall fail greatly there, as I failed humbly here." The fear quite chokes her. She sits down and cannot find the life in her heavy legs or the activity in her mind to rise again. The room is pale and strange, white sheets hung over every piece of furniture. Angelica, clutching a sheet to her bosom, turns to Suki with agony in her eyes.
"Please, please, do not tell him about what has happened."
"He must know, soon enough."
But her aunt hangs her head.
"Only give me a little longer. I cannot let him down so. I cannot do it."
And Suki, now carrying the sick anxiety of Angelica's secret, must continue with the great business of their home all alone, pattering up and down the stairs on errands without cease, with such scratching in her pocketbook as to make her mother proud. When Mr. Hancock returns home in a trance, Suki rages at him.
"Where have you been? Look to your wife! She's not well!"
"Oh?"
He has spent all day standing over the mermaid's tank. His feet are pearled with chilblains from the dirt floor, and his eyes ache for searching the black surface of the water. He has not powdered his wig or visited the barber or changed his clothes for many days, but he feels that the longer he gazes upon the mermaid, the better he can hear the words she whispers. At night, lying sleepless by his sleepless wife, he fancies he hears the mermaid's voice. It must be her voice, no louder than the mutter of somebody deep in dreams. Soon he will understand what she is saying.
"Are you listening to me?"
Suki stands before him, but even as she speaks, he fades away from her as if he was slipping down into deep water.
"Your wife needs you, and yet I think that has no meaning for you."
And no, it does not, for he does not go to her, and he does not ask her how she goes. It is on this day that a messenger arrives at Mr. Hancock's London counting house.
"A note for the gentleman," he says.
"Regarding?"
asks Scrimshaw.
"His use of the outbuildings at Greenland Dock."
"He is not here."
"He is there so rarely now. He has made no arrangements for another voyage, and no attempt to go in on any other. The clerks fret and pursue business as best they can. Perhaps this is what happens to a man when he attains gentility." The messenger heaves his shoulders a little.
"My master wants this message delivered to his own hands. We've pasted up bills on the building itself, but he persists in using it. What does he have in there?"
"As if that concerns you,"
snaps Scrimshaw, who has positively no idea.
"'Tis not for you to wonder what a gentleman does with his own property."
"If it were his own. In fact, Captain Tyso Jones has relinquished a lease on it and left it cluttered with rotten rope and rendering drums and Lord knows what else. We are not a common tip, you know."
He thrusts the note out more vigorously.
"We are businessmen, same as you. Won't you see he acts on this information in short order?"
"You wouldn't give it to him yourself? How is this practical?"
"He don't listen to a word we say," says the messenger. "He goes his own sweet way. He can't very well disregard what is written on vellum and sealed,"
he puffs up his chest,
"with wax."
"Leave it with me," says Mr. Scrimshaw. "He'll be here by and by."
"No, I want it took to him now."
"So you take it to him."
The clerks are stirring themselves, watching the conversation with some interest.
"Yes," they murmur, "you take it." "I am paid by the letter," says the messenger. "They will not pay me more for a long walk. Besides," he adds, putting a letter on Scrimshaw's lectern,
"'tis your business."
Scrimshaw sighs.
"Oliver,"
he rolls his eyes to his youngest clerk. Oliver looks mournfully out of the window at the heavy sky and the first spits of rain on the glass.
"I shall take it when I go to deliver the other papers to Mr. Peyton," he says. "I've not the time for two errands."
Scrimshaw squints challengingly at the messenger.
"Well, that must satisfy you. We are busy men."
In the corner, Mr. Gerald puzzles over the bawdy riddle Mr. Percy has doodled for him on the back of an invoice. And so this note is crushed into the pocket of Oliver the clerk as he departs on an errand to the docks at St. Catherine's. He strides swiftly with it as far as the top of London Bridge, but the sky is darkening and spits of rain are misting upon his face. On such a rough night, he wishes to go no further in his errand, but take himself into a tavern and see out the weather with ale and laughter. He presses the note and a few wafered coins into the fist of a small boy sheltering in the porch of St. Magnus the Martyr,